This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Dan Friedel and Katie Weaver have the Higher Education Reports on a program with the goal to increase the number of black doctors. Anna Mateo presents this week's words and their stories on the expression gild the lily. Later, we continue our series on America's presidents and learn about the 31st president, Herbert Hoover. But first,
the American Medical Association, AMA, recently said the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on affirmative action dealt a serious blow to the medical field's goal of increasing the number of black doctors. Affirmative action describes the idea that it is good for society to favor people who come from groups thought to have been discriminated against in the past. Earlier this year, the nation's high court ruled it is unlawful for colleges and universities to consider race in choosing students. Because the Supreme Court's decision includes medical schools, the AMA said the ruling will hurt gains made in the battle against health inequities. Many medical schools used affirmative action ideas to increase the number of black students. But even with those efforts, a University of California at Los Angeles study in 2021 said the percentage of black doctors had only increased by 4% from 1900 to 2018. Experts believe increasing the number of black doctors could help black people's health. Right now, only 6% of physicians in the U.S. are black, but 13% of the population is black. A series of reports by the Associated Press, AP, said that black people do not get taken care of as well as white people, starting at birth. The AP reported that patients said doctors ignored or brushed aside their concerns, partly because of bias and racism within the U.S. medical system. Uche Blackstock is an emergency doctor in New York City. He wrote a book called Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Medicine. He called the low number of black doctors a crisis of humanity.
Starling Tolliver is a 30-year-old black doctor trying to influence people's opinions. She is in her final year of residency, or training, in dermatology. A dermatologist is a doctor who specializes in diseases of the skin. She is training at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. As a girl growing up in the Midwestern city of Akron, Ohio, she felt like her dream of being a doctor was out of reach. She did not often see doctors who looked like her when she went for treatments for a condition that caused her to lose her hair. She stayed with her goal of becoming a doctor because she made an agreement with two friends. When they were young, they all said they wanted to be doctors so they could help other black people. One of the friends, Charmaine, became a nurse, and one, Maria, died as a teenager. Tolliver said Maria's death made her work harder. "I'm going to continue to go on this path of medicine," Tolliver said. Not only for myself, but for Maria, and to potentially help others in the future from similar backgrounds. Tolliver's plan of being a skin doctor might be a good way to help Black people. The Association of American Medical Colleges says just 65 of almost 800 applicants for residencies in dermatology were Black in 2020. But many Blacks do not go to dermatologists for treatment.
The AP reports that minority patients are half as likely to see dermatologists when compared to white patients. Also, more Black men die from skin cancer compared to men of other races. That information came from a study published earlier this year in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Some education experts say ending affirmative action might increase interest in medical schools at HBCUs, or historically Black colleges and universities. Morehouse College in Atlanta receives over 7,000 medical school applications each year for only 115 openings. The medical school's president and CEO is Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. She said she expects the number of applicants to rise at Morehouse and other HBCU medical schools. Tolliver, the dermatology resident, said financial aid programs that target minority students who are interested in becoming doctors are important. The American Academy of Dermatology has a program called Pathways. Its goal is to increase the number of minority dermatology residents from 100 in 2022 to 250 by 2027. The program aims to help young people who are interested in medicine and guide them into dermatology. It targets high school students and supports them as they go to college and medical school. Some receive financial aid.
Azaria Providence is a 17-year-old high school student who lives in the U.S. Virgin Islands. She hopes to be a dermatologist one day. She joined the Pathways program last month. She wants to be a skin doctor so she can help other girls who have skin problems like she did. She said she never had a chance to talk with and learn from minority college students and doctors before. Providence said it is important for Black people to learn to care for skin because some problems appear differently on Black skin than white skin. She hopes more people who look like her can get a correct diagnosis and the correct treatment from dermatologists. Adam Friedman is a dermatologist and the leader of the department at George Washington School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He said, "Updating textbooks is important, but programs such as Pathways are very important." As Tolliver finishes her training, she said she hopes she can push dermatologists to seek better outcomes, especially for Black women. She said her goal since childhood has been for Black women to see the beauty of themselves within themselves. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
We'll be right back. Now it's time for Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We give examples and notes on usage. Before we talk about today's idiom, let's talk about words that you will need to know. Guilt and gild. Guilt, as a noun, is the gold, or something that looks like gold, laid on a surface. It can also be an adjective. Gild is a verb. It means to cover with a fine layer of gilt. Sometimes we add gilt to a plain material, like wood, to make it look better. In fact, entire buildings can be gilded to make them more pleasing to the eye. Word experts say American writer Mark Twain created the term Gilded Age. In the 1873 novel, The Gilded Age, A Tale of Today, he and co-writer Charles Dudley Warner made fun of newly rich people. They discussed how these people would cover wood and other objects with a thin layer of gold to make them look more costly. So when you gild something, you could be trying to cover up something ugly. But sometimes we may try to improve something that cannot be improved. It is already wonderful just the way it is. And our attempts to make it better can make it worse. Take, for example, a lily. Lilies are beautiful flowers. Like many beautiful things in nature, they do not need any additions to make them more beautiful. And that brings us to the idiom, gild the lily. If I gild the lily, I add some unnecessary decoration to something already beautiful. The thing I add is superfluous. It is not needed. Imagine if someone added a really bright, shiny gold frame to the Mona Lisa painting. The frame is so bright that it is hard to see the smile on the famous woman. That would be gilding the lily. However, we use this expression to talk about anything, not just artwork or objects. We gild the lily anytime we try to improve something that is already excellent. For example, my friend has good bone structure and lovely skin. She's just gilding the lily when she wears makeup. Here is another example. Once I went to a beautiful garden. It had flowers of every height and color. It had a fish pond and was completely lined with beautiful trees and bushes. The garden was beautiful and peaceful. It was perfect. And then the owners built a tall structure in the middle of it. The structure was made almost entirely of stained glass, like church windows. And while it was beautiful, it was truly gilding the lily. When the sun shone through it, you could not see one flower. Here are some expressions that are similar. To go overboard, to overdo it, or to get carried away. Listen to this example.
I got carried away with the decorations on the birthday cake.
Yeah, you really went overboard with the sprinkles. The cake was so pretty, and now I can't even see it.
Experts on the website Merriam-Webster explain where the expression came from. The website says that gild the lily comes from Shakespeare. but the expression has changed over the years. In his play, The Life and Death of King John, the line is actually to paint the lily. Here is the shortened form from that play, Act 4, Scene 2. To gild refined gold, to paint the lily, to throw a perfume on the violet, is wasteful and ridiculous excess. These days we just say, gild the lily. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Anna Mateo joins me now to talk more about this week's Words and Their Stories.
Thanks for having me on your show, Dan.
Anna, I learned a lot from your story today, which explained the expression, gild the lily. I have to say, I've never used this expression. And if I have heard it before, I didn't know what it meant. It's kind of amazing that as a native English speaker, there are still expressions I'm learning.
Exactly. I learn something new every time I write a Words and Their Stories. And while I know this expression, gild the lily, I didn't know about its connection to Mark Twain or Shakespeare. So Dan, now that you understand this expression, can you think of an example for gild the lily?
Some people have really nice cars, but they feel the need to get fancy tires or paint it a bright color. I saw a car yesterday with a purple light shining below it, and they would be fine without those extra additions. So many cars often gild the lily. Am I using that right?
That is a perfect usage of the idiom to gild the lily. You are a quick learner.
It was also interesting to learn that gild the lily came from Shakespeare. It seems that so much of modern English comes from Shakespeare. Do you know any other common words or expressions that Shakespeare invented?
Oh my gosh, there are so many common expressions that come from Shakespeare. In fact, back in April of 2016, I wrote a Words and Their Stories titled From Shakespeare's Pen to Our Mouths. In it, I share many expressions that come from the famous playwright. For example, it's all Greek to me, meaning you're confused, and green-eyed monster, which means to be jealous.
Cool. Thanks, Anna.
Thanks for having me on your show, Dan.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Herbert Hoover. He took office in 1929. Hoover was president for the early years of what Americans call the Great Depression. During those years, the United States economy slid into a severe recession. Many banks and businesses failed. At times, nearly one in four people in the U.S. workforce were unemployed. Millions of people lost their homes and savings. Hoover did not cause the Depression. The conditions had been in place before he took office. But many Americans blamed Hoover for their suffering. They believed he permitted the economic crisis to continue and even deepen during his time in office. Herbert Hoover was born in a small house in the state of Iowa. His parents were Quakers. Their religion valued simplicity, hard work, equality among people, and peaceful resolution of conflict. Hoover and his brother and sister were influenced by these beliefs, even after their parents died. By the time young Herbert Hoover was 9, he was an orphan. He moved to the state of Oregon in the Pacific Northwest and lived with an uncle. Hoover did not thrive in that situation. Reports say that he usually kept to himself, and he did not do particularly well in school. Yet one official from Stanford University liked what he saw in the young man: hard work and a desire to learn new things. At the time, Stanford University was just getting established. It admitted Hoover into its first class. Hoover had to work hard at Stanford, both in class and to earn money to pay tuition. But the experience brought many benefits. Hoover studied geology and went on to work as a mining engineer. The job led to positions in Australia, China, and other parts of the world. He became an internationally known expert on mining. He also wrote a leading textbook on mining. These experiences, along with good business investments, led to great wealth for Hoover. At Stanford, he also met the woman who would become his wife. Her name was Lou Henry. She was the first woman from Stanford to complete a study program with a degree in geology. The Hoovers went on to have 2 sons. During World War I, the Hoovers' lives changed dramatically. The family was living in London when the war began. U.S. government officials asked Hoover to organize an evacuation effort for American tourists who were in Europe. In only a few weeks, Hoover's committee succeeded. Later, he helped get food and supplies to people in Belgium. As a result, Hoover earned a public image as a smart, skilled humanitarian. When the United States entered World War I, President Woodrow Wilson asked Hoover to lead the government's Food Administration. In that position, Hoover led an effort to change Americans' behavior in order to support the war effort. He asked them to limit the kinds of food they ate and goods they bought. The effort was, for the most part, successful. Americans called their moves to limit their consumption to Hooverize. Hoover went on to organize programs to aid other countries, including Russia. He also helped parts of the U.S. recover after terrible flooding. And as Secretary of Commerce, he pushed businesses, researchers, and government officials to work together. Hoover aimed to reduce boom and bust cycles and keep the U.S. economy healthy. In all his efforts, Hoover urged Americans to choose to participate. He did not believe in using government requirements to force cooperation. Instead, he supported individualism, the idea that Americans must protect the qualities of creativity, equal opportunity, and service to others. Hoover's beliefs were popular with many Americans at the time, and with many Americans today. In the election of 1928, Hoover easily won the presidency. He promised to continue leading the country down the path of prosperity. When Hoover took office in 1929, he said, "I have no fears for the future of our country. It is bright with hope." That was in March. In October, the U.S. stock market crashed. Thousands of investors lost their savings. The event was part of a sharp downturn in the economies of the United States and of many other countries. At first, Hoover believed the downturn would pass. But as time went on, the situation grew worse. Businesses could not expand their workforce. Farmers could not afford to harvest their crops. Everyday people had too little money to pay for housing costs and, in some cases, food. And then banks across the country began to fail. President Hoover worked hard to fix the problems. He tried many approaches, creating government agencies, urging private and public groups to cooperate, and working to balance the federal budget. But Hoover did not want to use federal money to provide direct aid to Americans. He worried that such actions would make people dependent on the government and reduce people's individual power and morale. Nor did he want to use the federal government to try to control the economy. Government intervention, he said, would lead to socialism and eventually destroy the country's founding beliefs. Instead, Hoover tried to support states and businesses indirectly and urged people to find ways to help one another. Yet many lawmakers and members of the public rejected Hoover's measures as insufficient and even cruel. Some used his name differently than they had before he took office. Now, they called the dirty shelters where hungry and homeless people lived Hoovervilles, and they called men's empty pockets Hoover flags. Although Hoover tried to persuade Americans that he was protecting their interests in the long run, voters refused to elect him for a second term. Instead, they overwhelmingly chose a president who promised an activist federal government and a hopeful New Deal for Americans. After they left the White House, the Hoovers retired to their home in Palo Alto, California. Lew Henry Hoover died in 1944, but Hoover lived 20 more years, many of them working for the public good. He helped international relief efforts, advised the U.S. government, and led committees to reform the presidency. Hoover also commented on later presidents and their policy decisions. He was especially critical of government programs set up to provide aid and intervention in Americans' lives. Until his death from cancer at the age of 90, Hoover remained committed to his beliefs. He spoke for limiting the power of the federal government and for supporting freedom of opportunity for individuals. But in the eyes of many Americans, Hoover is linked to the failure of the federal government to lessen the Great Depression. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.